Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is May 23rd, 2019. This is episode 139. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
Stuart Lindebaum.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Stuart Prest.
Welcome back to the podcast, Stuart.
Hey, it's great to be here.
On today's show, we're going to get you to help us talk about the Greens' climate plan. They have one.
They have one. I'm shocked, shocked.
Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. And if you ever have feedback for the show, email us at podcast@politicoast.ca. So let's talk about our Maine-only segment. It's been a kind of quiet week. We have tons of quick takes, but let's talk about a newer, greener deal. The Green Party this week released their Mission Possible Green Climate Plan.
Which is not the latest movie where Tom Cruise runs a lot.
Or becomes increasingly superhero-y. This is the Greens promising to exceed the Green New Deal US and the Pact for a Green New Deal calls and save the world. Will they do it?
No.
The Greens set out a 20-point platform that ranges from what everyone's doing now, calling for a climate emergency, to vague things like assuming leadership, to some more specific things. I know you have lots of thoughts and opinions on this, Scott. So what's your first issue with the Greens' climate plan?
How bare bones it is really my main takeaway here, which is not great because if you expect any party to like really dial down and get their stuff right on this, you think it would be the Green Party, who their whole raison d'etre is to be the environmental party. But overall, there isn't much in here that you would not have guessed just by thinking, oh, what does a Green Party person like? It's more targeted, I think, to like a low information voter who kind of has a general sense of what the Green Party is and not a serious plan to tackle climate change. Now, it sets out some pretty ambitious targets here, such as by 2030, getting to 60% below 2005 emissions levels and zero emissions by 2050. But how it gets there is a little vague.
Yeah, it's a six-page document. The first page is a title page. The next two pages are talking about how important it is to have a climate plan. Then pages 4 and 5 are the 20 points of it. And page 6 is, oh yeah, and reconciliation. But I'll get to that bit later. I don't know if you had a chance to take as detailed of a look at it, Stuart, but what was your kind of takeaway on this plan?
I have not had a chance to read it in detail. I mean, 6 pages, come on, I'm a busy guy. But it is, it reflects, I think, some of the perennial challenges the Green Party has in terms of trying to signal to core Green voters, what do they want to see, right? So these are the kinds of messages that you'd expect in terms of assuming leadership and some of the other Green messages around political process, right? So assuming leadership, respecting evidence, trying to signal that they are not like some of those other parties out there. So there's some of that separation being placed into the party and the point about establishing a cabinet involving all parties. So trying to be a different kind of political, almost being a different kind of political process as a party, which is becoming a bit of a Green Party issue when you're asking voters to vote for the town hall debate, right? Vote for us because the environment is a serious issue and we are going to categorically act to have a debate. So there are reasons why they end up in that place. One is that a Green Party is a very good, what I call a question party. Great at asking the question, what are we going to do about the environment? They are not a natural answer party, right? Our ideological parties, the Liberals, the Conservatives, the NDP, you can sort of estimate within a few points margin of error where they're going to land on any given issue, including the environment. Is the state going to be involved? Is it going to be market-based? You can start to sketch out if they choose to deal with that issue, how are they going to deal with it? The Green Party doesn't really do that. if they attach themselves to the global green movement, it tends to be more socially progressive on the left side of the spectrum. But the Canadian Green Party doesn't always do that. So we see where the Green Party has sort of put down some roots, say in the Vancouver Municipal Council, they tend to be pretty middle of the road. And they also sometimes have divided caucuses that are going to have debates about what's going to happen. And so voting for the Green Party, I think, it can send a very strong message that all you other folks are like, we don't like what you're doing, and we don't think if you're a Liberal Party, you're going far enough. The NDP, we're not sure that you're really committed to this rather than other projects like LNG development. Like, where do you stand? So it's a clear statement. This is more important than anybody else is treating it, and yet it doesn't get us all the way to a coherent answer that you're presenting to voters. There's an uncertainty there.
Yeah, I think there's some good elements in here, and there are some clear elements in here. They want to ban fracking, and that's what we would come to expect from the Green Party. It's another approach to expanding fossil fuel extraction and reliance on that. And their argument is spending more time on that is putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yet, oddly enough, in one of their points, the same one they talked about banning the import of foreign oil, they talked about upgrading Canadian refineries and oil processes, which seems counterproductive if the idea is to get off fossil fuels, and especially since they've spent the last year and a half now complaining that the Liberals bought a pipeline and are spending money on fossil fuel infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they also want to go hard on biofuels and biodiesels as, I guess, a transitionary tool. The problem with biofuels is it uses up a lot of farmland that would otherwise be used for food.
They have a solution to that, though. Their biofuels are going to be locally sourced, small scale, primarily relying on used vegetable fat from restaurants, because you can totally replace the 520,000-ish barrels of diesel Canada burns every day by using some used fry oil. But I think that point is particularly illustrative because it really, I think, goes to one of these ideas that permeates the Green Party that is just not realistic, which is that the modern economy can be replicated with just a lot of small scale local stuff, and the economies of scale just aren't there in a way that works.
Well, and that kind of permeates through their buy everyone electric cars platform. Now, they're not literally buying everyone electric cars, but they do have the ambitious target of 2030 all new car sales being zero emission vehicles in Canada, and that's 10 years faster than British Columbia has set as a target, which is already an ambitious target for North America. Some European and elsewhere in the world nations and jurisdictions are looking that fast.
Norway's close to 45-50% now.
But so they've been working at it for a while.
Yeah, they've been working at it for a while. And what's even more ambitious is the next thing they say, which is by 2040, there will just be no internal combustion vehicles, which, when you figure that it takes about roughly 20 years of production capacity to like replace all the cars we have right now, that basically means you have to be going 100% EV next year, which is insanely ambitious and not going to happen. Or you need to get a lot of people out of their cars, which is oddly absent from here. There's a point in there about improving rail service, so, you know, maybe getting rid of the like long distance car trips, but in terms of your like everyday vehicle uses, it's mostly driving around the metropolitan area where you live and work. And oddly enough, there isn't much in here about public transit at all, or even just improving walkability.
Yeah, they talk about, quote, get Canada back on track. And it's worth just reading that one platform plank, number 11. Modernize via rail. We could all hope for that. Expand service and ensure transmodal connections across Canada to light rail and electric buses so no one in rural and remote communities lacks efficient, affordable, and safe public transit, which is fine, but the type of big moves Vancouver is making are talking about how do we get half of all trips or more out of cars. And we're already on a good track for that, but Vancouver's one of the few cities in North America being ambitious enough to do that. I joke sometimes, you know, ban cars. I know we never will because I grew up in a rural town, but that's the kind of ambition you almost need the Greens to be talking about.
Yeah, and there isn't much here about banning cars or really much about cities at all, which is, I think, a big oversight here, considering about 80% plus of Canadians live in a city. We're a very urbanized country, yet urban issues are almost entirely absent from this document. And, you know, if you miss 80% of the country, do you really have a climate plan?
There's certainly something, seems like a gap there in trying to address that. How do you get people moving around? How do you get people engaged in understanding development, transportation development on that sort of scalable level, right? When back to your sort of fry out comment about how do you move around the country? It's Vancouver is an example, and this is going to be a bit of Vancouver triumphalism a bit, but right, it's a city that has been trying to approach issues regarding some densification and transforming transit for a period of time now, and it has had some good success doing it. And it's for that kind of reason that Vancouver's emissions are well below the rest of the country, and so you need that kind of planning. It's some less... sexy? I hate it when people use that. But less sexy planning. It's more logistics. It's redesigning your cities and trying to make things a little closer together and make things a little taller and get people in a position where they can make different kinds of choices. You're all about empowering choices here. And so some of these platforms, they are going in a good direction, but they aren't part of a national plan at that sort of integrated level, which seems like what we would really need. Of course, in a federation like Canada, that kind of national level planning is hard to achieve because this is a federal Green Party and they don't get to plan Canada cities. And so that's a challenge just due to the fact that we're a federation.
The federation definitely complicates things on a national plan, especially because so much of the decisions get made in provincial capitals or at city halls. But at the same time, the federal government routinely chips in 40% for major transit projects.
Yeah, I mean, they could move towards fully funding transit programs or, you know, 50% or something like that,
not only upping that, but then putting strings on that funding so that, you know, if the government of Canada is going to spend $3 billion to build a subway line in Vancouver, maybe you should also require that the city allow apartment buildings near that subway line so that there's actually a return on the investment made and you're actually like getting good value out of the federal spending on that.
Now you're getting back into the classic battles of federalism. What kind of strings can the federal government attach? So that's, again, this is a challenge that Canada's institutions are in some way uniquely poorly designed to meet. And there's always resistance to the federal government putting strings on funding, but it has done it in the past. And maybe this is a situation where that is justifiable. And again, this is the Green Party. So you would want this document to be the most ambitious in the country. And yet they're also, and this is a problem, the NDP has had in a different form, and now the Green Party is going to have to deal with it. Is this a party about governing, or is this a party about bold ambition, right? It's in terms of the NDP, it's always been about is not to get us elected, but it's to say what we think is the right way to go forward. Or is it to make the compromises necessary to, we think, get us elected? And this document, some of the things it says when we're talking about upgrading Canada's refinery capacity, you don't often expect a Green Party to endorse additional infrastructure spending on the oil and gas industry, but trying to get the Canadian industry rebuilt in a sense is kind of doing that. And even if the proceeds are going to green outcomes, and I'm sure that would be part of the plan, this is a document that speaks to a party that's thinking, well, maybe we have a shot here to play a stronger role in Canada's government. And of course, the polls, which are currently all over the place, suggest that at least in the wake of Nanaimo Ladysmith, the Green successes there in PEI, this is a party that may actually be able to make some noise. So, I mean, it's good this is a document getting some scrutiny, and the party is going to have to deal with that question. Are we reformers or are we green radicals? That has been a divide for the Green Party and wherever it's emerged, and that I think is going to be something that this party is going to have to deal with.
Scott, you wanted to talk about F-35s, though.
Yes, because For some reason, the Green Party felt they wanted to include that in a climate plan. Specifically, point 18 talks about changing planes and how the Green Party wants to buy water bombers and cancel the F-35 purchase, which is a little like saying we shouldn't be buying fire trucks, we should be buying ambulances. You kind of need both, and framing it as an either-or is very unhelpful, and I think fundamentally at odds with the previous point, which is point 17, prioritize adaptation. Climate change is projected to cause a lot of global instability. We don't know what the geopolitics of 10 years from now is going to look like. So part of being prepared for that and that unstable world is maintaining the ability to assert our sovereignty over Canada. And part of that means you need to have planes that are capable of denying airspace to planes you don't want there. And that's an F-35. So I guess what I'm saying is part of a climate adaptation plan needs to include fighter jets, submarines, and naval patrol ships, because you need to be able to maintain that stability. And part of that is being able to use armed force when required.
I see the argument, and I don't necessarily disagree on the pragmatic end. And I see even Dave Moskrop is getting weirdly into military policy.
Oh, I am
policy.
Here for Dave Moskrop getting to be a defense nerd.
What I'll say about the Greens, though, and what I would expect they would talk about is, Stuart talked about the Greens as a question party, but globally there is kind of a Green manifesto. They have what's called the Global Greens Charter, and I have to just assume the Canadian Greens are at least a signatory to that in principle. And those basic premises are ecological wisdom, social justice, participatory democracy, sustainability, respect for diversity, the kind of things you'd expect. But the other one is nonviolence. And I think the Greens historically are tied in with a kind of pacifist movement.
Oh,
I think that's where this flows from.
Yeah, like
and
some
I
of their
don't
previous
necessarily disagree with it personally, even if that's a optimistic naivety of my own.
Yeah, it's a very optimistic one and not one that I think is pragmatic at all at this juncture. And yeah, in previous elections, they've had some downright nutty ideas when it comes to defense policy.
So I think that touches on most of the elements of the document. Like I said, it's 6 pages, so it's worth people skimming through, because I think most policy documents are worth skimming through just to get a sense of what the branding is, what they want to pitch themselves as. But what is missing from what we would each want to see as a ideal climate change document? From, you know, what's the boldest visions that we should be seeing? Because this is the Green Party. They should be the high bar for climate action.
Well, so we talked about some of those boring logistical issues and the fact that, I mean, cities matter. So I think that really does have to be there, right? Question of emissions for consumers, a lot of it is transportation, and that's a municipal issue above all. And so, and grappling with those issues of Canadian federalism, how is the federal government going to induce, cajole, incentivize action in all Canadian cities, not just the ones like Vancouver that are already somewhat geographically bounded, and they've bound themselves further with their land use policies in the lower mainland. Other parts of the country, they need to find ways to start going down that path further and faster as well. So what is the Green Party thinking about what we can do for Edmonton and Calgary and Winnipeg and, you know, on down the line, these cities that are not currently designed to make mass transit easy and affordable and accessible, but that's going to have to be one big part of the plan. And likewise for housing as well, making sure that when we do develop these cities, they're developed in ways that can be more energy efficient. That's just, so there's going to have to be one part of the thinking.
Transportation and electricity is definitely a big part of it, but that's also not even half of emissions in the country. And that, I think, is what's most striking about this, is what it misses, which is stuff like agriculture and industry, cement and steel production. All of these are huge sources of greenhouse gas emissions, but they don't merit a mention in here. And I think part of it's less consumer focused, but concrete, for example, I think is the second most used substance on the planet after water. Can't recall the exact number off the top of my head, but somewhere in the range of 4 to 9% of world emissions are from it. Like, it's, I think, bigger than the airline industry. Like, this huge amounts of climate change is driven by just what we build. And there isn't an easy solution to that. I mean, there's some research being done, but it's still way too costly and not ready for widespread use. But you can't really address climate change without figuring out a way to make steel without using large amounts of coke coal, or make concrete without having to heat the cement as part of the cement manufacturing process, or even actually figuring out a way to just stop it releasing carbon dioxide as part of the curing process once it's cast. Like, all of these things are just really complicated problems that need solutions. And, like, you know, it's easy to point to electric cars and wind turbines and solar panels. Like, they're, you know, for lack of a better term, the sexy climate solutions. But, like, it only scratches the surface of the problem. And you really need to find a way to do industry well and cleanly, and that's nowhere to be seen here. So, like, I think they get a massive incomplete on this assignment because they ignore, like, a huge chunk of the problem.
So we need to disrupt cement.
Yes.
Your own job.
Oh, yeah. No, I work in the, like, it's, and, you know, there's ways around using some of it. Like, mass timber is a great alternative for buildings, but you still need concrete foundations. There's a lot of things where we don't even really have an alternative material that would be great, because there are some problems where just a big chunk of durable, heavy stuff that you can make in any shape you want is what's needed. Oh. And
like wind turbines.
Yes, they actually have large concrete foundations and then steel towers.
Yeah.
Like, that would go a long way to solve this. And we're going to have to build out a lot of infrastructure, and we need to figure out how to make that infrastructure clean, not just in its use, but in its construction.
Yeah, I think both of you touched on what I want to see. But the other element for me is the climate crisis is tied so deeply in with, like, broader crises we're seeing, I think, in politics and economics. We've seen such a government needs to get out of the way focus of political parties over the past 30 years. And this is a kind of solution that begs a collective response. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And there are parts in here in this green platform that recognize this and are great. You know, I think the idea, and you kind of mocked it a little bit as a discussion forum of the, like, all party committee, but the way they kind of pitch it, to their credit, is, you know, it's the war cabinet to solve the issue. And I'm mixed about the war metaphor as a mobilization response, but
yeah. I think it's maybe a little better than the New Deal metaphor.
Yeah.
Like, just briefly tangent here, like, you know, this is just such a massive problem, and one that, you know, if we're really serious about, is basically going to be the next 30 plus years of the primary focus of the government, making it kind of the second thing in a big social welfare state expansion maybe doesn't get the order of priorities right. And that's my concern about where the American discussion's going on this.
Well, and this is begging for a restructuring of the economy. Whether it stays as a heavily market-based economy or not is a separate debate, but we need to move from an oil-based economy, which is Canada's, a resource extraction one, to one that isn't.
Yeah.
And that's going to be painful for a lot of people, and there's nothing in here. I expect the Greens will launch something else about economics, but there's nothing in here about what do all the oil workers in Fort McMurray do? How does Alberta's economy transition? And we touched on that. What do we do with Atlantic Canada that was hopeful for offshore oil wells? All of these questions are left unanswered. And that's what I think the Green New Deal stuff tries to address, is there needs to be an economic transition as well as a environmental one.
Even that, though, leans a lot more on government expenditures in the social service sector rather than jobs. But that's something that's interestingly missing here, is the jobs thing, too. You'd expect they'd be talking about exportable green technologies, which would be huge. And, you know, it's often an argument that Canada shouldn't do anything because we're too small. But if anything, I think that's the argument that we should be focusing more on exportable technologies. Wow. Because, like, for example, Africa, continent of over a billion people, probably going to be two by the end of the century, is rapidly developing. And, you know, how they go about it could make a massive difference in how the planet responds to this. And if that's done through fossil fuel-based stuff, it's not going to be good. But if, you know, there's an opportunity for Canadian firms to sell clean technology there. Like, that could actually have a huge downstream effect that would be bigger than the entire emissions from Canada.
On that point about the best time to start changing things is 20 years ago. There's a real cost to some of the choices that get made at one time or another, right? When we're contemplating providing some kind of government support for one industry over another, Canada supported, or I mean, particularly Alberta, but not just Alberta, also Newfoundland and BC in various ways, different kinds of extractive industries. And at the time, Canada was really pursuing those avenues. And it, I mean, we're talking about the 1990s and 2000s, where governments were really taking strong action to try to induce that kind of industry. Countries like Germany, even the United States, even China, were developing a renewable sector. And just as you're describing, this opportunity to create exportable green technology, that's great. Canada is several steps behind that process now. So we are much more likely to be a net importer of green technology than we might have been had we really taken it seriously at the time when it was first. I mean, in the 1990s, it was reasonably clear at some point down the line, all this is going to be a real change for the whole world. We're like, it's going to happen at some point. And now we're a lot closer to that. We can see it happening. There's, you can project out for most countries, when are they going to hit peak oil consumption? And it's not that far away, but it's just a little too far away to stave off significant implications for the global climate. But that has been coming for a while, and it's still coming now, and Canada can still make some choices to try to think about different kinds of industries. Even the way the carbon tax is structured right now, it tends to encourage the most efficient version of the industries you already have, but it's not really designed to try to transform the economy. And so one thing a Green Party could do is think about how can we induce economic transformations in ways that are less painful rather than more painful, and more enticing rather than less enticing. Because right now we have this just pitched battle where people either see climate change as a big deal, we need to do things right now because look what's coming down the hill. It's coming over the horizon. It's bad. And then everyone else says, well, we have to still maintain our GDP. We still have to find people jobs. And we just don't have a way to unite those two conversations there. Not the only version of two solitudes in Canada, but they're a really important version, perhaps the most stark version of two solitudes in Canada today.
Well, and I think that brings us now to the last segment of this conversation, this discussion is, what are the politics of this? You know, how can the other parties react to this document, and what space has potentially a incomplete Green Party climate plan opened up? To kick it off from my point of view, on what I was talking about in terms of that broader transformation, the NDP actually has a huge opportunity here. Jagmeet Singh seems to have been woken up by the Green victory in Nanaimo Ladysmith that maybe some people actually care about this climate change issue, and maybe he should talk about it more. He did talk about it in the leadership race, but it's been a very confused policy since. And I think even during the leadership race, he was kind of flip-flopping on Kinder Morgan until he ultimately came down against it, realizing that's where the votes were. And this could be the motivation for the NDP to take that broader look at how do we transform Canada. And it won't be appealing to everyone because, you know, as you talked about, Scott, there are other approaches that, hey, a different Conservative Party might actually be able to take up. But maybe that's where Justin Trudeau goes.
Perhaps. The Liberals are kind of boxed in a bit on the environmental file. Like they've done some good work. The decision to phase out coal power alone is going to have a fairly big effect. But the big headline that everybody's going to be thinking about in the election is the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which makes it very hard for them to take the we're the best party on climate position. So that's tough. And then on the NDP side, I don't think there's a unanimity within the party's base on it, because you have a lot of the kind of blue-collar union worker part of the base that been looking at, say, LNG in BC and seeing the next 10 to 20 years of jobs for them. And I'm not sure if Jagmeet Singh can sell the idea of, okay, you're all going to be building wind turbines now.
Yeah. It is interesting. I was, so in 2015, I wrote a column talking about the progressive primary, right? It seemed like the NDP versus the Liberals, there was a competition who's going to carry the progressive banner for a while. It looked like it was going to be Tom Mulcair and the NDP, and then Justin Trudeau and the Liberals rallied and took that flag and ran with it. And there was a real rallying around the sort of the ABC anyone but conservative movement around the Liberal Party. Right now, what we seem to have is something of a green primary, right, where the Liberals, the NDP, and the Green Party are all making pitches to voters about how they're the right choice to be the party that you vote for if you care about the environment. So the Liberals say, we balance concerns for the economy with concerns for the environment. They are, again, to their credit, the party that has really stuck their necks out on a federal carbon tax, which is, as much as anything, it's not enough, and yet it is more than anyone has accomplished until this point. So they have a track record to run on this issue. Meanwhile, the NDP, they do seem to be caught up on this dilemma about, are we the party of jobs for working Canadians, right? And then the jobs in Canada are still attached to extractive industries. And I mean, in BC, we have debate around LNG, and that seems like that is still tripping up Jagmeet Singh. Is he in favor of LNG development? Is he not? Where does the party land in terms of how much are we all about the environment? How much are we all about all these other things we care about? And so, and there's always a risk, though. If you really go in all in on one side or the other, then you lose your audience on the other side, right? So those who really do care about jobs for working Canadians and are less concerned about the environment, because not everybody sees this issue in those terms. And it seems like they're really trying to process that risk still, and they're doing it in real time. And we kind of see the meandering of the policy as a result, which is, that part is not ideal, but it's a real dilemma that they face. And then the Green Party, like I said, have this debate. Are they going to be the standard bearers for the ideal green future, or are they going to try to triangulate a little bit and try to say, we are going to be a little bit better at green issues than anyone else in these ways that we are going to articulate here, but we're also going to be this deeply realistic party, which means that we are actually going to hedge our bets a bit on transformation. So who's going to win the progressive primary?
Well, one final question on this before we move on is, the Green Party's doing a lot better, but with that comes increased scrutiny. And one of the reasons we've spent our primary segment talking about this is, you know, based on the latest poll, which we mentioned last week, is the Greens are basically collecting nearly a third of the vote in the province here if the election was held today. Are they going to be able to withstand this increased scrutiny that's going to come at them? Like, we've spent quite a bit of time going through this and like talking about how inadequate what should be their centerpiece platform is going to be. And there's other issues surrounding the Green Party that's have come up in the past. And, you know, basically, will this be sustainable with the increased scrutiny that comes with having a real chance of holding the balance of power in a minority government?
Well, I mean, this is the right time to be running out a policy statement, because they can collect feedback, right? They can, you know, listen to podcasts being recorded in Vancouver on a Thursday evening, and they can maybe tweak the policy. They can flesh out some of the points that we're saying, well, why isn't that there? Like, well, hey, look, it is. Hey, so you just have to wait, right? They have time to do that still. There's a long time between now and the election. So I think the scrutiny can in some ways help them in that regard. And they are a party that benefits from additional attention because they never got it before. Now suddenly people are talking about them. PEI, Nanaimo Ladysmith, success, I think, Guelph in Ontario, right? So they have a few different successes they can point to, so they deserve more attention. And the scrutiny makes them seem more serious, which is fair because they're winning elections. And so I think that is, that in that sense, it's going to be beneficial, even if some of the scrutiny is critical. And if they are open to the scrutiny and then the criticism, and then they respond well to it, then they can make an even stronger platform. This is going to be a challenge for them. The Green Party has not needed to have this level of performance before, right? Part of politics is, in some ways, it's a profession. You can be good at it, good at your job, and good at messaging, good at the war room and all this sort of stuff, or less so. And so they're going to have to up their game a little bit in responding to some of these issues. And we will see if they can make that transition. That's going to be one piece of this story. Another piece, which Ian, you referred to a little bit ago, was about issue of reconciliation. And so that is an indication that the party may need to still work on how they respond to criticism. But maybe you want to talk about.
Thanks for bringing that back. I had totally blanked that I even teased that I was going to lead into that. Yeah, they mention in here this kind of in the last lines, and they say, and we'll, of course, work with Indigenous partners. And that's not a bad thing to say, but it's clearly not woven through the platform in a way that you would expect a party that was taking proactive steps to work on Indigenous issues. And I bring that up mainly because this past week, I think it was Robert Jago had a piece in the Taii slamming the Greens for their failures to really engage with Indigenous issues over the past 4 years, just Elizabeth May in particular in the House of Commons. And rather than kind of take that criticism in good stride, her constituency manager, I believe, was tasked with writing a response, kind of documenting all the time she brought this up in the House of Commons as a, no, actually, we do care. And Jago again did another response just going, eh, proof's in the pudding. And it's that tension. And, you know, Jago's a strong voice. And if you piss him off, good luck. But I think he's one worth taking seriously. And that doesn't mean you have to appease him. But kind of trying to be listening and learning is going to be that challenge. You know, this increased scrutiny is that double-edged sword. The Greens have been begging for people to read their platforms, like we've spent almost an hour on it. And when people do, I can just already see the tweets coming of people going, oh, you're not fair on this or you're not fair on that. And that's the nature of politics. So you have to be able to roll with those criticisms. And hopefully they do learn from them. I mean, the Greens are the most, at least on paper, open to change. And participatory democracy, I said, is one of their values. So I'm interested to see where this election goes. And I have sympathies and hopes for the Greens. They're not ultimately where I end up voting most of the time because they tend to be, like you said, too much of a question and not enough of an answer. But this is a start, and I hope it's not an end.
And I think it's fair to say the Green Party may not be all the way there on what their answer looks like, but the fact that they put the issue of climate front and center, for anyone who's looked at other parties over the years, there may be a certain amount of frustration on the lack of sustained attention or the constant sort of hedging of response. You can say, well, maybe it's time to look at the Green Party more seriously, that maybe all these other parties really aren't able to address the issue with the primary focus that it deserves, right? And so that maybe they deserve a little more attention in that respect, but they are going to have to rise to new challenges, right? With new opportunities comes new risks. And I think it's going to be worth watching. They are a useful voice in Canadian politics, even though, given the structure of the first-past-the-post system, every time you add another party to the mix, you add unpredictability to the mix, right? So it's a bit like a chaos engine now, right, where a few percentage points one way or the other is the difference between a majority or a minority or a different minority. So this election is going to be hard to predict ahead of time. It's going to be fun to watch and also probably a little terrifying for everybody.
Moving on to good takes. The Premier has called on the BC Utilities Commission to answer the question about why gas prices are so high.
It's another inquiry. We have money laundering and now we have an inquiry into gas and diesel prices. I think this one is less of a formal public inquiry and more of BC Utilities Commission. Figure this out and tell us what we can do. The terms of reference are kind of interesting to look at. They task the BC Utilities Commission to look at things like the difference in refining margins between BC and the rest of Canada, the difference in retail margins, whether things like access to refineries, the amount of gas stored in BC, refinery and pipeline capacity, interestingly, market size and demand, methods of distribution, seasonal variations, competition, and other measures might affect it. But notably, the inquiry is not to look at effects of provincial enactments or policy, aka taxes.
So it's the find out who to blame, but you can't blame us.
Find out who else to blame.
And the BC Liberals have spent a lot of time harping on the NDP about, you know, you have the power to lower the taxes and make gas prices lower, but it's a very fixed amount. It's about 34 cents a liter. And you drop 34 cents a liter off $1.70 and you still have some of the more expensive gas in Canada.
Right. And you've just lost 34 cents that goes to things like building highways. So, paying for TransLink, paying for transportation in the province. Money, it's got to come from somewhere else if it's not coming from this tax. So it's not like it's just money being taken away to be mean. It is money that is providing public goods. And this, I'm kind of interested to see what the result is, because I've poked around into the gas price differential, and it seems like it does run about maybe 5 cents higher in BC than the rest of the country. So maybe there is some kind of supply issue, and maybe we'll learn something about that. It seems like it's a big black box right now, where industry insiders have stories about this refinery or that pipeline, and that explains what's going on. And I'm just a poor political scientist, so I don't understand all that yet, but I would be curious about that.
One thing extra gas will be useful for is fueling boats and Trudeau.
Ships. My Navy ships. Friends would be very upset with you right now.
Do you want to do that again?
I want to keep it.
Okay.
Fueling ships. Trudeau this past week was in Vancouver to announce $15.7 billion of funding to build up to 18 ships for the Coast Guard. I think a lot of attention got focused on just two of these ships, though, as they are Coast Guard ships being developed by the Irving Shipyard, effectively just to keep a contract going. The shipyard had been commissioned to build patrol ships for the Navy, and they finished that contract, and they were going, well, I guess we'll have to close our shipyard down and fire a bunch of people. And Trudeau went, why don't you build two more of those Navy ships, but give them to the Coast Guard instead? They can drive them around the Arctic or something.
Only during the summer months. Mostly. They're the Arctic Patrol vessels that were ordered under the Harper government as part of the National Shipbuilding Strategy, and they're smallish ships that can basically do like single-year ice, like light ice breaking, not the heavy multi-year ice that covers a decent chunk of the Arctic.
For now.
Less
for
every
now.
Year.
Yes. When people think Navy ships, you know, they think like big warships, but these are like small ships, and with what's effectively like a pea shooter on them. It's a 25 millimeter gun, which as far as like naval weaponry goes is nothing.
It's so, not clear that the Coast Guard will get the guns.
That's the other thing. It's like, we're probably not going to be arming the Coast Guard ships because we don't do that in Canada.
Probably.
So like overall, this is like, I can kind of see why, okay, if you're going to need like a smallest ship for the Coast Guard, you might as well do this. But like, it also really seems like a, well, we want to keep jobs in Halifax where these are being built, and because Canadian procurement policy is mostly about jobs and, you know, equipping our various government agencies second, well, of course, that's what they went with.
Procurement is hard. Procurement is really hard.
We make it harder than it needs to be. A lot.
But at a certain level, every country makes procurement harder. So there is... As much as I want to make fun of this decision, because, right, just buying ships to keep a factory open doesn't seem like a great use of money. But there are real challenges. And at a certain level, whenever Canada sees a procurement project through to completion and actually receiving some sort of ship or plane as a result, it's kind of a victory. So I think the fact that procurement is hard for a variety of reasons. One, it's because, right, there's debates around specifications. Those can change with times and governments. There are debates around where to do the building and the supplying, and those can change with times and governments. And then you have fierce fighting within the country about where is the production going to happen, or does the production happen in the country, or does it happen where it would actually be most efficient, which is not usually Canada. But that, because the sums of money involved are so great, the government does need to get some sort of return on investment in terms of employment, or that so goes the thinking, rather than just buying the most efficient ship and seeing none of that productive funding reinvested in the economy. So these are real considerations. It's not easy to do procurement. And have I said that enough times?
I think you might have. Although I just will point out that these are based on a Norwegian design, which we bought the design from, and then spent more money purchasing that design and redesigning it than the Norwegians spent on their entire project from the time they first pencil hit the drawing board to the ship entered the water. So we definitely made it harder than it needs to be and don't do it great. But these are only two of the ships. There's also 16 more that are going to be built here in Vancouver. Or just technically North Vancouver at the C-SPAN shipyard.
Are they all being built here? Because it sounds like they'll most likely be built here, but there will be an open bidding process where Davie and Montreal might steal some.
Yeah, so they announced that they're going to be opening up open process for another shipyard in Canada.
Right.
Spoiler alert, there's only one other major shipyard in Canada to potentially help out with some of these. But from the sounds of it, there's at least the majority of these will probably be built here in BC. Moving on, Andrew Scheer continues to roll out his ideas, what he wants to do, making a big speech earlier this week about how he really wants to crack down on human trafficking. So the previous Conservative government had a anti-human trafficking strategy that kind of lapsed, and you know, the Liberals took other approaches to dealing with the issue, and Scheer wants to bring it back. And it's kind of the, I guess, greatest hits of like Conservative crime policy, mandatory minimums, harsher sentences, making it harder to get bail.
A lot of things that have been struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada is unconstitutional. They want to do again. That's not surprising. I had to look up, because I was curious, how big of an issue is human trafficking in Canada. And Statistics Canada has some data from police-reported incidents. There's one report, at least, that looks at data from 2009 to 2016, and it does find that those numbers were rising in that period, notably even when the Conservatives' anti-human trafficking strategy was in place, but maybe it just didn't have enough time to bear fruit, or maybe the Liberals killed it and that's why it kept spiking. But the numbers are small. It's 1,200 over that entire period. The peak got up to about 325 incidents a year. Now that's 300.
Reported also too.
Yeah, and that's 325 too many. But like any crime stats, it's very complicated. And it caveats all over this report that this is very hard to measure. When we say police reported, sometimes those numbers build on themselves, because once the police report one, they're more likely to report another, because then it's in their mind that this is something to charge someone with. So I don't know that it's a solution in search of a problem. Human trafficking, again, very bad thing. No one wants it.
Yeah, that's that's the thing. There's nobody on the opposite side of this argument, but like, I guess it is meat to the base. Like, they'll be happy with a tough on crime stance, but I'm not sure it's also going to do much to pull new voters into the Conservative coalition.
Well, and it's coming on the heels of a foreign policy speech by Andrew Scheer. And so it seems clear he's trying to roll out a series of positions that are going to place the party as an alternative to the Liberals in terms of governance, and to say that they're not just opposing the Liberal vision, that they have an alternative vision. And this is, it's a good topic for them to try to signal the kind of things that matter to Conservatives. And so all the caveats about reporting are correct, and the problem that once is it a question of increased reporting, or is it a question of increased incidents? Those are questions that social scientists really care about, and we want to be right about those kinds of data when we're trying to deal with a public policy issue. So I think it doesn't seem fair exactly to say it's a convenient issue, but it is a sort of a typically conservative issue. Right? We can say that there are bad guys in the world and we're going to do things to stop the bad guys. It speaks to the sort of deep-seated conservative idea around trying to maintain stability and to enforce visions of law and order in society, and to maintain a status quo. And so those are all just strong conservative points. And what will be interesting to see is whether that plays back into debates around immigration as well, because this is a topic we see embroiled at the U.S. border, and that is, I mean, the technical term is clusterfuck. It is just a mess, and these issues get conflated, and there is real inability in the U.S. right now to have a reasoned, evidence-based conversation about immigration, human trafficking, terrorism. They are all just bundled together by mostly GOP speakers, and we really want to avoid that path. We want to make sure that this conversation does remain evidence-based. And so far, I mean, we're talking about the role of evidence in the decision-making. We want to make sure that these topics remain clearly defined as distinct policy areas, I think.
I don't know if it's the final Scheer speech, but the next interesting one is actually going to happen tomorrow, probably before this podcast is even online. But Scheer is scheduled to talk more about economic issues, and it's already been leaked to CBC that he has dropped a pledge to balance the budget quickly. Initially, it was reported he would balance the budget in 2 years, but now he said Trudeau has left us too much of a mess. It'll take at least 5 years to do it, which I get that that's probably a realistic and honest answer, but I don't quite get the politics for Andrew Scheer, who's running on, I'm going to be the guy who comes here to clean up the mess. Also, I can't clean up the mess in one term, so elect me twice, Canada.
Yeah, why not 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years seems like a much more natural number to pitch. Because it is I can get this done in this term.
Well, one economist who would love to be talking about these exact issues in the upcoming election won't be is Aaron Weir, who's announced he's not going to run again for his seat in Saskatchewan. He was kicked out of the New Democrat Party after it turned out he was allegedly very creepy around female members of the party and just generally... There weren't specific allegations, but things got hot enough for him that Jagmeet Singh suggested he find political affiliations elsewhere, and he listed himself as a member of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation. Once again, the CCF was reborn, and it looks like now the CCF will be gone, as Aaron Weir still doesn't get the NDP nomination, and he's decided it's better that he just disappear.
Well, it's an indication of a certain amount of change in politics. We're still grappling with what to do with politicians who come under scrutiny without public concrete allegations or tested allegations in the Me Too era. And yet it's something that can have real ramifications where sometimes it's time for politicians to go. Perhaps this is one of those times.
And one politician who wants to come back is former conservative politician Stephen Fletcher, who was a member of, I think, he wasn't a full member of the Harper cabinet, but he was like a parliamentary secretary. Right. And then he was a member of the Progressive Conservatives in Manitoba. And then he was an independent after he got kicked out of their party. And now he wants to run for the People's Party of Canada in Manitoba because the Conservatives still won't have him back at the federal level. And this is one of a few eyebrow raising, I guess, People's Party candidates, probably the least eyebrow raising when you consider the 9/11 truther they've attracted, the various anti-gay candidates, including Laura Lynn Thompson, who's now moved from Burnaby South to Red Deer for some reason, and a couple others around the country.
Hmm. Yeah, that party has undergone changes from its initial burst onto the scene under Bernier with Bernier's Twitter account. It seems like those are the co-chairs of the party, right? And they send very different messages about what the party's all about. And on the ground, the report suggests that this party is really going haywire, that there is not a lot of quality control in terms of candidates now. And so
I think that might be part of the fact that they're just probably not bringing in a lot of quality candidates. If you're on the right and have good credentials, don't have any sort of checkered past, you're probably going to run for the Conservatives. So it just sorts out a lot of kind of the people who'd be star candidates elsewhere and kind of,
yeah,
you get a lot of people who didn't pass the Green Light Committee or for other reasons feel like Andrew Scheer is too mainstream for them. Yeah.
And I think we've seen Scheer react enough to the creation of the People's Party that it really cut those legs off. You know, he picked up some of that UN Global Compact on Migration language, which was troubling enough, but otherwise kind of said to them, we're not going to talk about dairy, but we'll talk about all those other issues that you're really angry about, which turns out was most of the fuel for the People's Party.
Yeah, Scheer's basically been trying to close any gap between him and Bernier to, I guess, starve Bernier's party of oxygen.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's worked. So where once we were talking about a Conservative Party that really had to look over its shoulder right off the 10% outcome in Burnaby South with Ms. Tyler Thompson? Anyways, that seems quite a while ago now, and it seems like that might have been a one-off and not a trend that we're going to see elsewhere in the country, which really opens up path to victory for the Conservatives in the fall election. So that's one less thing for them to have to worry about.
Although they're not out of the woods yet, because even if People's Party squeezes 2 to 5%, that could be enough to rob the Conservatives of the vote they need to get over the majority line.
Yeah. And if it's
even the minority line.
Yeah. If it's in the right ridings, yeah, it can make a huge difference. And so when we think of a multi-party, five or six party environment in a first past the post system, like I said, it's a chaos engine. And so 1 or 2% drop down from 36% to 34% nationally, then that can be the difference between majority and minority.
And just before we sign off for the evening, Stuart, where can people find you if they want to follow you on the interwebs?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at my name, Stuart Prest, and here and there commenting on the news of the day. I'm around and happy to hear from people.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Susan Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.